The light-filled lands of grace sit proudly and gloriously upon the surface of the lands between, bathed in the eternal light of the Erdtree. Yet in the depths below these lands exists a society as sophisticated as anything on the surface above. In the ruins of an ancient civilization lie the lands of the Nox and their cities eternal, a race banished here for an act of treason long ago. Yet rather than let such exile defeat them or reduce them to cave dwellers, the Nox have developed a high culture to rival even Lindale itself. From the caverns, the Nox have proven themselves to be one of the most innovative peoples in the world of Elden Ring, developing incredible and sometimes horrifying feats of science and genetic engineering. Indeed, as we take a greater look at this society, one comes to realize that there are few people as influential as the Nox. Operating from their subterranean prison, they have had an irreversible effect on the lands between during their constant feud with the Greater Will and its vassals. If we look even closer, we can feel the hand of the Nox in different communities among the lands between, showing their fortitude and tenacity. In this video, we will dive deeper than ever before, looking at the science, the culture, and the history of one of the greatest peoples in the lands between. So join me as we venture into the night and look at the Nox and their eternal cities. So at the onset of this discussion, I would like to address what I see to be a common misconception that I see on Reddit and various lore videos. I do not believe the Nox are the same as the Nightfolk, and I have studied their models extensively to make sure I'm right on this. As you can see, the Nightfolk are very distinct, with silver eyes, silver hair, and light grey, silvery skin. They are clearly linked to the Silver Mimics, a relationship that we will examine later. Point being is the Nightfolk are distinctly their own race, from those that we know to be the Nox. As you can see, the Nox have even darker ash-coloured skin and yellow eyes, almost like the Sith from Star Wars, and I believe them to be a group of corrupted Numen. So while of course a lot of this is my own speculation, I do believe there is plenty of evidence to confirm this. Let's firstly start with the Black Knife armor of the Black Knife Assassins, which reads as follows. The assassins that carried out the deeds of the Knight of the Black Knives were all women, and rumored to be Numen, who had close ties to Marika herself. So straight off the back, we have the fact the assassins are Numen, and are most likely kin of Marika, who is also Numen, so this makes sense. However, we also learned that the Black Knife Assassins are referred to as Nox, from a dialogue as Roger, who says this about the Black Knives.
This is a Black Knife print. I can scarcely believe you managed to get your hands on this. You recall our conversation about the Knight of the Black Knives, yes? They say the assassins who carried out the deed were Scions of the Eternal City. A group entirely of women, arrayed in armor of silver under cloaks which fooled the eye.
So Roger says that these women were from the Eternal City, and therefore it is almost certain that the Nox are a Numen civilization. These assassins are very reminiscent of the female-only sword mistresses that we find in the Eternal City. Their armor describes them outright as Numen, but Roger names them as Scions of the Eternal City, i.e. children or people of the Eternal Cities, which means they are Nox also. Nox and Numen being used interchangeably to describe this group of women. If that isn't enough to convince you that the Nox are fallen Numen, then I feel there is some environmental storytelling that can help link the Numen society to the Nox and the Eternal City. And specifically, we're going to look at the habits of the ants. The ants are interesting because of their eating habits. The ants, of course, the ones we find in the underground sections of the game. I believe that their eating habits can actually confirm that the third destroyed Eternal City, found in the Deep Root Depths, was once inhabited by Numen, thus confirming the Nox and Numen are one in the same people. Let's start by looking at the ants' habitat in the Ainsel River, so the river surrounding Noxtella specifically. Near the Ainsel River Depths site of grace, there appears to be some kind of dumping ground. A dumping ground for corpses, as evidenced by the coffins and sarcophagi that we see lying around. These corpses appear to land in the river after being dumped here through a hole in the roof, and then are carried downstream to a gathering place of ants, a lair of ants, who all feast upon the corpses of the dead, and we can see this at numerous points in the Ainsel River. Then further in, we find a queen or pregnant ant that, if we kill, gives us a rune. Now this leaves me to speculate that the ants devour the runes from the corpses of the dead, and these runes are eventually used in their process of gestation, which is why when we kill these ants and burst their pregnancy sacs, they give us the runes that they have gathered in order to gestate a new ant. So let us apply these to the ants that we find in the Deeproot Depths, next to the potentially destroyed Eternal City. There are a lot of pregnant ants in this den, and when we kill them, they release Numen runes specifically. Given the destroyed city next door, it suggests that the ants have been feeding on the corpses of people here, and the rune suggests that these are Numen. And given that this is a fallen Nox city, it once again cements what I have always believed, that the Nox and Numen are one and the same. So this brings us to the question, who are the Numen and what do we know of them? Well, we do get a piece of evidence from the character creation screen when we choose this preset. Its description reads the following: supposed descendants of denizens of another world, long lived but seldom born. So these people are long lived people from another world, and have the same type of fair hair as Marika herself, as we can see from the preset that is suggested to us when we choose the Numen preset. The information is also backed up by two in-game items that relate to these people, Marika's hammer and the Numen rune. Both of the aforementioned items more or less say the same thing, that they are a people from outside the lands between and are of the same stock as Queen Marika. So what picture can we construct with this information? I would therefore speculate that before they were called the Nox, they were originally Numen, who, as we can see from these descriptions, were not from the lands between and obviously came here, established a new civilization, and Marika herself would be among this new society of Numen settlers. From this society, Marika would eventually be selected to be the vessel for the Greater Will, and we know that this society would then live for a time under Marika and the Greater Will. And we know this because it would be the Greater Will that would banish them underground, implying they have not always lived underground. We learn this from the armour set of any Nox character, and I will look at the Nox Monk armour set, which reads the following. Long ago, the Nox invoked the ire of the Greater Will, and were banished deep underground. So by implication, they once were surface dwellers, and their transition from Numen to Nox is an interesting concept to ponder. Given what we see of the Eternal Cities in our timeline, they must have developed their own culture, architecture, and beliefs that would distinguish them from their former identity, and it would be their commitment to their beliefs that would mark their transition fully into the Nox and would lead to their first act of treason against the Greater Will. The very name Nox hints at their core belief system. As of course most of you will be aware, Nox is Latin for night or darkness. Given that Nox society is focused on bringing about the Age of Stars, one assumes that their name followed the development of such beliefs. Let us examine the most core piece of lore regarding Nox society. This is the info, of course, that's found within the armour sets of the Monks, Night Maiden, and Swordstress, and it reads as follows. Long ago, the Nox invoked the ire of the Greater Will and were banished deep underground. Now they live under a false sky, in eternal anticipation of their liege, of the coming Age of Stars, and their Lord of Night. This piece of lore tells us a number of things and is one of the richest bits of lore in the game. Firstly, as I've already discussed, it proves that their civilization was once an overground one. It also, secondly, shows us the nature of their exile, that they have to live under a false sky eternally as a punishment. And finally, it also shows us their commitment to the Age of Stars and bringing about a Lord of Night to usurp the current Order of Grace. Yet before we tackle their societal structure, culture and goals, let us first tackle the act that would result in their banishment. I would posit that this action was the slaughter of a Two-Finger, for the item description of the Finger Slayer Blade, the Treasure of Nokron, reads as follows. The hidden treasure of the Eternal City of Nokron, a blade said to have been born of a corpse. this blood-drenched fetish is proof of the high treason committed by the Eternal City and symbolizes its downfall. Cannot be wielded by those without fate, but it is said to be able to harm the greater will and its vassals. This very item symbolizes the downfall of the Eternal City, and thus implying the event linked with this item is the reason for their banishment. Rani needs this blade during the course of her quest, in order to slay her own two fingers. However, it is heavily implied that Nox Society has already achieved this feat, as the description of this knife reads blood-drenched, therefore presumably drenched in the blood of a different two fingers before Rani even gets her hands on it. Another interesting facet of this item description is the act is named here as High Treason, again reminding us of the fact that these people once lived under the auspices of the greater will on the surface, given that treason is something you can only commit against an authority to which you owe fealty. Yet how are they able to develop such an extraordinary and powerful vassal slaying weapon themselves? As we will discuss later on in this video in numerous points, it becomes very clear to me that the Nox are true innovators, and their science, beliefs and developments in some way act as a precursor to a lot of the surface factions. Indeed, I see Marika's hammer itself as a symbol that the Numen were already craftsmen, and this is something that combines with Nox alchemy to explain their general inventiveness. With that in mind, let us now consider the Finger Slayer blade itself. So we can see the blade was born of a corpse, both in its unholy appearance in our item descriptions, and by the description itself. Now, there is another weapon in game that shares such grave materials, and that is of course the Sacred Relic Sword that is wielded by the Elden Beast in the final fight of the game. The Elden Beast, of course, forms this sword from Marika Radigan's body, and the description of the sword reads as follows. Sword wrought from the remains of a god who should have lived a life eternal. Thoughts on what the weapon portends are many and varied. Some consider it the mark of great sin, or a sign of great devastation. Some think of it as the end of an age, while others, the beginning. So there are a lot of incredible implications here that we can try and link back to the Finger Slayer blade, as clearly the Finger Slayer blade is a perversion of the same practice that made the Relic Sword. The Sacred Relic Sword is clearly meant to be symbolic, as well as to actually perform a certain purpose when it is wielded by the Elden Beast. To some, the sword is clearly negative, a mark of a great sin, the destruction of a god, but it is also meant to bring about the end of an age or the beginning of a new one. Indeed, does the Elden Beast not wield this sword right at the edge of a new dawn, of a new age, as a new age will directly follow our clash with it no matter what choice we choose? We can see that these facts also apply to the Finger Slayer blade, as it too is a tool meant to bring about great devastation, the death of the two fingers. In addition, it also was meant to bring about the end of one age and the beginning of another, for both the Nox and Rani clearly wish to use this tool to start a new age, the Age of Stars. So we have established that they perform similar functions, but why is this important and what does it mean? Well, it means to me, and I would speculate on this of course, the Nox have inverted or perverted this existing practice. Practice of smithing a corpse, something used by the Elden Beast at the conclusion of a game. To me, it is clear that the level of craftsmanship shown by the Elden Beast is of course on another level. One need only look at the level of elegance in the Sacred Relic Sword and compare it to the crude and disgusting Finger Slayer blade to understand that the former is the work of the gods. And yet, it also speaks to the ingenuity and the craftsmanship of the Nox that they were able to reverse engineer this practice. The description of the Relic Sword seems to suggest that people are aware of this practice, as they do speculate on what it means. My speculation, therefore, is that the Nox stole and inverted this process from the Greater Will itself, built the Finger Slayer blade from a corpse and occult practices, in order to force their new age. Clearly, there is a lot of symbolism involved in these weapons, and the Finger Slayer blade's description seems to imply a certain link to fate, so there are obviously cosmic powers involved with these swords that we aren't meant to fully understand, but suffice it to say, It seems to have the power to change the current age, and the Nox turned this fate against the Two Fingers in their Finger Slayer Blade. But which Two Fingers did they slay? Does it really matter? The blood upon the blade is proof enough that it was used against an intended target. Perhaps it was one of the broken fingers that exist in the Divine Terrors. Perhaps all of them. Or perhaps it was the fingers of the Glomide Queen. Given that she was also an Empyrean, perhaps she would sever her fingers, much as Rani does, before she acts against the greater will, and once free from her two fingers, she was able to lead the Godskin apostasy against Marika and her kin. This is of course speculation, but regardless of the reasons behind it, this act, this betrayal, the slaughter of a fingers, was the reason why Nox society would be banished from the surface and confined to the lands below as we see them in the game. So let us now tackle one of the big questions and the most obvious questions, which is, why are these cities called the Eternal Cities, and what is the deal with the false sky above their heads? Well, again, I think we should return to the core piece of lore, the armor sets of the Nox, which reads as follows. Now they live under a false sky, in eternal anticipation of their liege. So I think it's very clear that the greater will is the very force behind the Nox's current living conditions. The word now follows on from the description of their treasonous acts, suggesting a causal link between the two. To me, it is a sort of ironic and cruel punishment, and to me it explains the very name, Eternal Cities. Noxtella and Nokron both exist underground, and we can see indeed they do have a fake starry sky above them. In my mind, this is a creation of the greater will to taunt them about their age of stars that they are never destined to see. In addition, to ensure this punishment was as harsh as possible, they are made to wait in eternal anticipation. It is my opinion then that the greater will is the one that has made their cities eternal, so that they can look up at their false sky, forever. Given the Numen are already a long-lived race, it makes sense that the greater will just simply makes their lives eternal, so they will always eternally wish and look up at their fake age of stars. It is a curse, an eternal punishment, and it really shows the cruelty of the greater will in this respect. We know of three eternal cities of the Nox, and this is Nokron, Noxtella, and an unnamed destroyed city that we find in the Deeproot Depths. And supplementary to this, and very interestingly, EG describes Nokron and Noxtella as twinned cities.
I take it you've heard of the eternal city of Noxtella. Well, it has a twin, known as Nokron, the other eternal city. After years of expeditions, we've determined the location of Nokron.
This is interesting because twin things are consistently repeated in Elden Ring, and again showing that even the Eternal Cities fall within the twinned rules of the lands between, most likely twins having something to do with balance and opposites of one another, and perhaps it leads us to believe that the third wheel, the third city, was always destined to fall. But more on that later. We now have to also consider if the Eternal Cities were built underground by the Nox, or whether some force that banished them underground also teleported existing cities underground. Many of you will know from watching my videos that I usually always go with a more mundane explanation, and in this case I do follow it as well, as I do think it actually has greater implications for the Nox. The cities are intelligently built around the unusual topography that one would find in an underground cave system. This includes inverted spires and buildings that allow the Nox to use the cramped space more intelligently and efficiently by building on the roofs of the caverns. It's especially clear that they built these after being banished underground, given that some of the constructions we find in the cities are clearly done after their relocation, such as the dam at the entrance of each city and the bridge of Noxtella. This again leads us to conclude that the Nox were banished here with nothing, and yet built these incredible cities that fit so well in the cramped and unusual space of a cavern. The Nox also chose to build their new cities in the bones of an even more ancient civilization, and logistically this makes sense, as there will be foundations, flat and cleared land space for them to build upon. The Nox seem to have adapted well in general to their new habitat, building dams where necessary, and somehow training the local giant ants as mounts. But let's return to the much older civilization. This civilization is the one that built the Ul and Uld palaces that we find within the game, as well as the renamed Mogwin Palace, which seems to have been a mausoleum for this community at some point, as the palace map description reads, "In the lightless depths lies the grave of an ancient civilization." We can indeed see that the ruins of these palaces are vastly different in time when compared to the Noxian architecture. The old civilization ruins are clearly modelled on the more classical architecture of Greeks and Romans, as we can see from the composite Romanesque columns and the Parthenon-inspired Mogwin Palace. Also, as pointed out by content creator Quelag on Twitter, some elements of the ancient Sumerians have also been used as a point of inspiration, and I will link that Twitter thread below if you want to read more about her explanation and references used. The more classical stonework and allusion to ancient real-world civilizations firmly evokes the age of this fallen civilization. It is ancient. In stark contrast, one can see the Noxian architecture as far more modern-looking, with sharp Gothic edges, pointed arches, and windows. And it's at this stage in the video that I do owe a retraction on an older video. In my earlier Moog lore video, I conflated the two civilizations that we found in these depths, and stated that Mogwin's palace was a Noxian ruin, and of course this simply isn't true, as the two types of architecture are quite starkly different, and so I apologise and offer my retraction on that statement. Returning to the subject matter at hand, is there any relevance to the Eternal Cities being situated amongst these ruins? Well, perhaps there is, for the beings that are most clearly linked with this ancient civilization are the Clay Men, the annoying zombie-like enemies that we encounter in great numbers below the surface. The Clay Men are the originators of the bubble spells, and the item description of these spells can tell us something about these peculiar creatures. For example, the Great Oracular's bubble spell reads the following: "Sorcery of the Clay Men who served as priests in the ancient dynasty. The Clay Men search for lost oracles within their bubbles." So these Clay Men served the ancient dynasty. They are not in fact the ancient dynasty themselves. And I interpret this as the fact that they were created by the race that once formed this dynasty. The Clayman Harpoon even describes their occupation of the ancient ruins and infestation, suggesting they are almost bestial and feral without their masters to guide them. For if they were the fallen empire themselves, surely they would not act as much as zombies as they do in game. Furthermore, the Clayman Ashes reads as follows: "The warped remained of priests who search for revelation in service of the ancient dynasty." All of this together leads me to conclude that these are artificial life forms that, in absence of their master, have essentially turned into mindless automatons, and their probably melted features are the fact that they have degraded over time, and they probably had a more firm clay look to them before. And now, with no direction or no civilization to serve, they just seek out the old civilization's ruins without any real purpose in mind, acting as an infestation and essentially zombies. Their presence, however, is significant to me because they are a form of artificial lifeform, clearly created from some form of alchemy and magic. The Nox are masters of alchemy and the manipulation of artificial life. Therefore, I find the Claymen's proximity to the Nox extremely intriguing. Is it possible that the Nox derive some of their science and technology or inspiration from the dregs of this ancient society? I believe that it's certainly possible, as we see lots of examples of Noxian attempts to manipulate life, and soon we will return to that subject of science and life manipulation at the hands of the Nox. However, before that, I would like us to examine the structure and nuances of Noxian society itself. So despite being exiled from the surface to live underground, the Nox have managed to develop a robust, rich, and advanced community that is a testament to the strength and intelligence of these people. We can say from the way in which their towns are built that these were real communities, with churches, houses, and open spaces. As we will see in the next section of the video, we have already discussed the fact that they are innovative, inventive people, and they would use this inventiveness to better their life underground and in some way outstrip the technologies of the lands above. Such innovations include the use of ghost flame for street lamps and extremely advanced elevators that are far more advanced than anything we see on the surface, including that in Leyendale. Around these solid foundations was a society religious in construction, a dark reflection of the Golden Order, venerating the Black Moon of Noxtella, as I think we can see in the black circular reliefs on their buildings. We can also see other references to it in the black marble backs of their chairs, which has the same black marbling as the Black Moon fragments we see in the memory stones, suggesting to me that, of course, these marble back chairs are meant to represent their Black Moon. I believe the Black Moon to have been central to the early Nox society, and we will touch on it again, but the Moon of Noxtella talisman describes the moon as a guide for stars, and no doubt the Nox would hope that their Black Moon would guide stars to them, bringing about the Age of Stars, and therefore it clearly will have been an important part of early Nox society. The clergy of this knight religion is headed up by the Knight Maidens, a fitting opposite number to the Finger Maidens of the Greater Will. We learn of these women from their attire, for example their twin crown, which reads as follows. Twin crowns worn by the Knight Maidens of the Eternal Cities indicates the highest clerical rank and hides the eyes with silk. So an interesting piece of lore that first of all confirms the fact that these maidens are the top of the pile when it comes to Nox society, clearly held in a position of great religious authority. The reverence in which they are held is further indicated by the silk that hides their eyes, as in real world religious practices, shielding high religious figures from the sights of the common people is of course a pretty common practice. Another interesting aspect is the crown which we have to consider, the twin crown, the twin points that protrude from their headpieces. We have already discussed, and in general it should be fairly obvious, that the idea of twins is an important cosmological constant in the world of Elden Ring, and so it is therefore not a huge surprise that we see it here represented on a piece of religious iconography. Unfortunately, we don't get a huge amount of information on what the twin concept means here on this crown, though it could likely be representing the twin cities of Nokron on Noxtella, or the counterpoint between the Order of Grace and the Age of Stars, or their counterpoint between the Erd Tree and the Moon. Let me know your thoughts on this in the comments below. This hierarchy is then supported by a warrior female cast known as the Sorceresses, and their armour description reads as follows. Armour worn by Sorceresses of the Eternal City. These women are the personal guards of the Night Maidens and wear silk capes. So the Night Maidens are important enough to warrant personal guards, and these personal guards are extraordinary and nimble warriors. In my opinion, the way in which these nimble warriors move is reminiscent of the equally nimble Black Knife Assassins, who were most likely drawn from their ranks, but we'll touch on that more directly later. Finally, we have the only male cast that we are aware of, and that is of course the Noxian monks. Given what we know about the Nox maidens being at the top of the pile, and the sorceresses being their personal guards, we can assume that monks fall further down the hierarchy, of course still playing some religious clerical role, but with less authority than the Night Maidens. This in turn leads me to an interesting consideration about Noxian society and its dynamics. It ultimately leads me to believe that it is a matriarchy, i.e. a society, where women fill the most important and prestigious positions of power. Of course, the most obvious piece of evidence for this is the Night Maidens themselves, a female-only position which encompasses the most important religious and political power in Nox society. Their personal guards too are an order of female-only warriors, again reinforcing the idea that the main positions of power are filled by women. Indeed, you will notice that the statues within Noxtella and Nokron are all of female figures, showing their importance to Nox society. And if you look even closer, the specific Nox-style chests that we find within the Eternal City, these are unique chests that we find only here, have women on them as well. Indeed, one must also consider that the other characters of importance that are linked to the Eternal City are all women as well. These being Marika, once a member of Numen Society, the proto-Nox Society, was once one of theirs as well, Queen Marika, now the god of the current order. We also have the Glowmide Queen. Again, we'll touch on her later, but there is some connection to the Eternal City to a degree at least, and again, she is also female. And finally, we have Rani, who in some ways is the heir of the Noxian Ames, and again, she too is female. The relationship to the moon in general does seem to be female dominated. The two beings we see connected to the moon directly, Renala and Rani, are again female, suggesting that there is some connection between the female and the moon, a theme that has also been explored to a surface degree in prior Soul games, but this connection is made all the more probable here. So with a basic understanding of the makeup of this society, let us now examine some of the more extensive and impressive scientific innovations of the Nox. In a lot of ways, Noxian beliefs regarding astrology, fate and the stars are very much a precursor to the practices we see adopted by the preceptors of the Carian royal family. For example, it was the Nox that first developed the fate manipulation technique, known to us as puppetry, and this would later be revived by the Carian royals, who we clearly see using puppets to compensate for their lack of numbers during their conflict with the Raya Lucarian Cuckoo Knights. We have already commented on the fact that Nox were clearly skilled scientists, craftsmen and alchemists, and this practice is one of the clearest examples of this. We learn that this is a Noxian practice from the item description Starlight Shards, which reads, "A prized item that was once used in the Eternal City as an ingredient in intoxicating drafts." This intoxicating draft is of course the draft that Celavis would later brew to enslave people as his puppets. We can extrapolate that the fate latent within the stars is being manipulated to achieve this by reading the Amber Starlight Shard item, which reads, "If the stars command our fate, then amber-hued stars must command the fates of the gods." Such is the belief that inspired the use of these shards to prepare a most special draft. So by simple deduction, regular Starlight Shards must command the fate of ordinary beings, and through some unknown alchemy, the drinker's fate becomes tied to those who prepared the draft, making them puppets on a string, the string being made of their fate. Despite being puppets, it does appear that each puppet retains some individuality, something of themselves inside that, according to Celavis, feels different person to person.
"The soul of every puppet has its own ambience. You'll soon come to know, once you possess a few. And once each's predilections are known to you, the better you'll be able to love them."
Yet while Celavis preys on unsuspecting or easily manipulated individuals for his source of puppets, in Nox culture, they didn't really have an issue when it came to sourcing fresh puppets. As the description of the Night Maiden and Sword Mistress puppets reads the following, "These sisters, members of a cold-blooded race who wield flowing weapons, became puppets of their own volition." So here we can see that Nox society is so fervent in their beliefs that they will willingly sacrifice their own flesh and independence for the greater good of their goals. But why would they even develop this practice? What does it achieve? Well, if you think about it in the way that puppets function, it essentially creates a pair of reusable soldiers that can be remotely operated. Puppets work by having a body sequestered somewhere, and then being able to summon a blue phantom of them at any given time. A phantom that, when defeated, can simply be resummoned over and over and over again. Noxian skill at alchemically altering fate within the stars is also highlighted by another creation of theirs, the Celestial Dew, a concoction that seems to be able to turn back fate, effectively curing any sort of antagonistic relationship. And you can imagine how useful that would be if one didn't want to carry on a certain conflict. Yet their innovations when it comes to alchemy and other experimental processes do not end with puppetry and the Celestial Dew. Indeed, it seems as though the Nox developed all sorts of procedures, no doubt as an attempt to gain power over the greater will and finally bring about their Age of Stars. Another example of this is the Dragonkin soldiers. The three that we encounter in game are situated in and about the Eternal Cities, and are therefore related to them. This is in fact confirmed by the Frozen Lightning Spear incantation, which reads, "Incantation that channels the power of the Dragonkin soldiers. The Dragonkin were born in the Eternal City, where they knew no true sky, nor true lightning, instead ice lightning was their weapon. So this confirms that not only they were a product of the Eternal Cities, but that their skills and abilities are also a product of their natural environment within the underground systems. Instead of being able to draw upon the power of lightning within the open sky, as the ancient dragons did, they instead need to form an artificial version made from ice. We also learn more about the creation of these Frankenstein-esque beings from the Dragonscale Blade, which reads as follows. A weapon made by sharpening a gravel stone scale, thought to be the source of ancient dragon immortality, into an unclouded blade. Alas, the Dragonkin soldiers never attained immortality, and perished as decrepit, paled imitations of their skyborn kin. Again, the innovative, if grotesque, science of the Nox never ceases to amaze me. Much like past Souls games, we see here a group of people, like Aldia or the Dragonscale cultists of Dark Souls, have tried to recreate the powers of the dragons in an artificial sense. Much like in Dark Souls, the immortality of the dragons seems to be linked to stone scales, and to get a better understanding of this relationship, I would like to read you the description of the Lightning Strike incantation, which reads as follows. Ancestors of the modern dragons, the ancient dragons had scales of gravel stone and wielded lightning as their weapon. It is said that they once attacked Laendel, the royal capital. So therefore, this creates for us two classes of dragons in the world of Elden Ring. First, there's the immortal ancient dragons, with stone scales, gravel stone scales, such as the ones we see at Fire Mazula, that exist beyond time and can wield lightning, with Lich Dragon Fortisax one among their number. Then there are modern dragons, which are of the type that we face numerous times across the lands between, such as Adula and Nagil, which of course look less stone-like, more bestial, and lack the ability to wield lightning. So specifically, the Nox are looking to wield the power of the ancient dragons by essentially creating their own hybrid dragon warriors. But why? Well, obviously the dragons are powerful, once even serving as the Greater Well's chosen vessels, ruling over the lands between, and it's most likely that those early Numen settlers who predated the Nox will have witnessed the dragon's reign before one of their own, Marika, would take up the mantle of God, but that's a little bit of artistic speculation for you there. Yet it is more than this, and I believe we can get the answer, really, why the Nox are after the power of the dragons, from the description of the ancient dragon smithing stone, which reads as follows. Smithing stone made by polishing a golden gravel stone, a scale of the ancient dragon lord and hidden treasure of Fire Mazula. This stone lightly twists time, allowing the creation of a weapon capable of slaying a god. So in the power of gravel scales, which are able to lightly twist time, is literally the power to destroy a god, Marika, and therefore given the aim of the Nox, this would be a useful tool for them to have. Despite their failure, the Dragonkin remain powerful weapons as we can see when we fight them. Ultimately though, they are freakish failures, slightly pathetic and unusual looking. Powerful for sure, but crippled abominations they remain, unable to obtain true immortality, and are failed replicas of the ancient dragons of old. Yet these Dragonkin are not the only lifeforms that we find among the Nox of the Eternal Cities. We must of course discuss the phenomenon known as the Silver Tears. Most will be well aware that the Silver Tears seem to inhabit the Eternal Cities and fight alongside the Nox. And in my opinion, if we look at a combination of in-game lore, environmental details, and cut content, we can clearly see that the implication is that these are again creations of the Nox. So let's talk about them. I've already mentioned the malleable claymen of the ancient fallen empire the Nox find themselves inhabiting. Is it not possible that they took inspiration from these creatures and began to cultivate their own forms of life? We've already seen one example of the Nox trying to create life, the Dragonkin soldiers, and over the course of the rest of this video you will see that this is just one of many attempts. That being said, I do not believe the Silver Tears are 100% artificial, like the Albinoryx, a subject to which we will return to momentarily. So let us start at the most logical starting point for the Silver Tears, and that is looking at their larval cores. Their item description reads as follows. Core of a creature of mimicry known as a silver tear. As much a substance as it is a living organism. Material required by the amber egg cradled by Rinala, Queen of the Full Moon, to birth people anew. So lots of interesting information there. Let us start with the look of the core itself, which of course is meant to be reminiscent of a human organ, showing in some way that they are a living being, and we will come back to the function of this organ in a moment. Yet they are not only living organisms, but a substance as well. A substance that the Nox use in the smithing of their weapons. Yet how did this living substance come to be? Well, I believe that the answer can come from the character creation screen. For the silver tears, when they transform into human form, take on the appearance of the so-called Nightfolk. The Nightfolk are one of the preset character models that we can choose for our Tarnished, and the description of this preset reads the following. Few in number, they were said to bleed silver long ago. So given that the Tarnished can be a Nightfolk, I believe that they are of course separate beings from the silver tears we face in the Eternal City. A silver tear cannot be a Tarnished by itself. But the fact that they bled silver, and the default human appearance that silver tears choose are Nightfolk, it leads me to conclude that the blood of the Nightfolk, the silver blood that they bled long ago, was somehow used in the process for creating this life form. The Cut a See Me questline is a very interesting resource for this, as she says the following line.
Great Lord Horst, may I ask something of you? A chalice is close by, the cradle of my kind.
Now, as I always say, take cut content with a pinch of salt, and I won't already retread content that has already been covered much better than I could ever do. So if you are interested in learning more about this cut content, I will link Nolrin's video on the Asimi, as they do a great job at recreating this entire questline. Regardless, this line that we've just listened to is interesting, because it does indeed show that the race was created. Asimi describes the cradle and source of her kind as a chalice, once again making us think of the alchemical processes and inventions of the Nox. It is just speculation on what we know about the Nightfolk and this Asimi cut dialogue, but I believe the Nox certainly at least had a hand in altering these beings, through the use of silver blood of the Nightfolk, similar to the process of their puppets' drafts, and that these sacred chalices are essentially the original test tubes in which this formula was created. Whether you believe they are natural or genetically altered, what is clear is that the Nox have managed to harness not only a sophisticated and dangerous life form, but a versatile subject from which they can create their unusual weapons. For example, the description of the Nox flowing sword states, a grim weapon wielded by swordsmen of Eternal City. This shotel has a blade as fine as a needle. Forged from the liquid metal of a silver tear, it was thoroughly tempered until hardened. So the materials that form their weapons are so unique, having been formed by this signature living substance. Simultaneously hard, but also flexible, we as the Tarnished are able to see how unique and versatile these weapons are, if we are unfortunate enough to find ourselves on the other end of a Nox weapon. Not only are they as hard as steel, but they can also move like water, transforming into whip-like substances in the case of the Sorceress, and the Nox Monk are able to transform their hammers into two buckler-like shields. Right at the onset of this video, and at numerous points since, I've made it clear that I think the Nox are exceptional craftsmen and alchemists. And even now, they are using a living substance to form a very versatile and unique weapon that is solid and supple simultaneously. Yet this is small potatoes compared to what these beings are actually capable of. We know that the sentient balls that guard the Eternal Cities are in fact a form of silver tear, given that they drop larval cores when killed. Their forms are malleable, and they can mimic any life form or any shape. They can twist their shapes into offensive and defensive weapons, or they can completely transform their being into new forms, becoming humanoids or even trolls. Really, they can take any form that suits their particular purpose at that time. And for me, the silver tier is really two component parts. There is the malleable and silver fluid on the outside of them, which allows them to shift and change their form. And then there's the organ, the larval core, at the centre of this substance, which is responsible for moulding the living fluid into the form most suited to its purposes. The reason I believe this to be the case is the way in which Rennala uses the larval cores. She uses them as an agent or medium for change to rebirth beings. This organ has the power of change and transmutation. For example, Bok is actually able to change his form from a demi-human into a human form if we give him a larval core to use with Rennala. He actually changes his full-on species. There are even silver tears that exist out in the lands between, pretending to be other beings before transforming into something more dangerous and attacking you when you break their disguise. It's almost as if these mimics are taking on the role of an infiltrator. Their utility is therefore very clear. They can be warriors, weapons, monsters, or spies. No matter the manner of their creation, whether they are naturally born of the Nightfolk blood or a descendant of them, or whether the Nox had some hand in genetically altering the blood to form these beings, as I believe, it is clear that these beings work with and serve the Nox of the Eternal City. Yet there are even greater implications for the role that these Tears can play within Nox society. Whilst they are useful warriors and spies, remember the true objectives of the Nox. They wish to place a Lord of Night upon a throne. And with that in mind, let us read the description of the husk of a Silver Tear, which reads, "The Silver Tear makes a mockery of life, reborn again and again into imitation. Perhaps one day it will be reborn a lord." Is it possible that the Nox hoped one Silver Tear would one day be able to mimic over and over and over again until it took the form of a lord? Their Lord of Night. I believe that this is the most likely explanation for their creation and their purpose. This seems more likely when we consider the Asimi cut content again, where she seems to try and become the Lord Eternal opposite to your Elden Lord through a process of becoming a clone of the Tarnished Host. I do believe that the Nox hope that this might be an avenue to obtain their Lord of Night and bring about the Age of Stars, that these Tears might one day take the form of a Lord of Night. Now, before we move on to the next chapter, one cannot help notice one final question that these beings leave us with. Is there a connection between the Silver Tears and the Albinoryx? Having ruminated on the matter, I do believe that the creation of the Albinoryx is linked somehow to the Silver Tears, and at the very least, they are both created by the Nox. Potential connection rises between them for a number of reasons. Number one, both are the only beings I know of to bleed white blood. Two, a larval core can randomly be found amongst the corpses of the Albinoryx in their village. And three, of course, being that they are both creations of the Eternal Cities. So this subject is, of course, to a degree speculation, but one I believe is extremely logical. So let's explore how the Nox created the Albinoryx and how they are potentially linked to their previous creations, the Silver Tears. So let us again start by once again returning to the greatest lore item in the game that I'm sure fans of the channel will be delighted about, the Albinoryx Blood Clot. And this incredible item reads the following. Albinoryx are life forms made by human hands. Thus, many believe them to live impure lives, untouched by the Erdtree's grace. So the Albinoryx are out and out artificial beings fashioned by human hands. And having examined the Nox, no society fits the bill better for the Albinoryx creators than they do. Indeed, these suspicions can be directly confirmed by cut content, showing at the very least the intended origins of the Albinoryx before it was cut. What I'm referring to is a line that is cut by the NPC known as Tops, and again thanks to the lore hunter who provided me with a text dump of the game where I was able to find this line. In the dialogue, Tops would have stated, "Oh, one more thing, beware the Albinoryx. A cursed souls born of a forbidden rite of the Eternal City. The curse withered the legs of the old, and silenced the tongues of the frogs, and now they hold deep grudges for anyone left untouched." Even without this really direct bit of cut content, it is obvious to me that the Nox are responsible for the Albinoryx creation. So if you do choose to ignore this cut content, and you are of course free to do so as it is cut, I still believe the conclusion is the same, although this dialogue makes it all the more clear. So let us look and theorise about the Albinoryx's actual creation, and the best source of this can be taken from the Albinoryx shield, which reads as follows. The ornamentation represents the primordial drop of dew from which they are said to have been created. Immediately, this brings us back to the alchemical prowess of the Nox, suggesting once again the Nox have created a new race from some kind of compound. Indeed, the term dew makes me think of the celestial dew, another concoction of the Eternal City. Further clues to an alchemical process being the genesis of their existence is hinted at in the description of the Ripple Blade, which reads the following. Unique weapon wielded by young Albinoryx. This sword is modelled after the ripples that are thought to be the origin of their species. The ripple, of course, is meant to evoke thoughts of a liquid or chemical process taking place that would then birth this entire race. All of this adds up to what I believe to be quite clear. The Albinoryx are born from a synthetic liquid, which is related to the Silver Tear concocted by the Nox. To me, there are enough links between the Silver Tears and the Albinoryx, the implication to me being that the fluid of the former was used in the creation of the latter. Even the Albinoryx blood clot does seem to be silver blood, much like the Silver Tear. Firstly, of course, we have the fact they are both of the Eternal City, both have a pale pallor, and both have white blood, and also the intriguing lore that we find in the item description of the armour that the Archer Albinoryx wear. The description of this blue-silver set reads as follows. Blue-silver is a metal born from the same mother as the archers themselves. So this blue-silver is born from the same mother as these Albinoryx archers, the silver and the Albinoryx being one. Now, we really could get carried away and get dragged down to a full lore discussion about the Albinoryx, but suffice it to say, whatever or whoever this mother is, it has a connection to silver, an element that creates the Albinoryx and also makes this silver material. A coincidence, I think not. While this connection is of course my speculation and you can choose to ignore it, at the very least it should be clear that the Nox created the Albinoryx. No other people are as reviled, hunted or persecuted as the Albinoryx are, and we get evidence of this deep-seated racial hatred towards them, illustrated by the Albinoryx pot, the description of which reads, "The Knights of the Cuckoos do declare, behold thy defiled blood, unlike any humour that flows in our grand realm." Examples of their persecution includes being hunted by cuckoo knights, being casually massacred by Gideon and his men, the experimentation of them by Rykard, and the massacre at the Sage's Cave. The persecution of the Albinoryx in the Land Between takes on a more symbolic note now. Here is a being created artificially, a mockery of what is seen as quote-unquote normal under the Order of the Erdtree. Indeed, the fact they are fully artificial seems to rile up a deep-seated hatred, or at least a coldness towards the Albinoryx, as if they are a lesser form of life, or not even life at all. Unnatural blood is apparently the cause for such hatred, and we can see with the Golden Order's treatment of crucible-touched beings that this idea of purity is definitely one that is constant throughout the Golden Order's ideals. And simply put, this might be the very reason that the Nox created the Albinoryx, because they are contrary to the current Order's way of thinking. And by flooding the Lands Between with this artificial lifeform, they throw a spanner in the works. Or could a more sinister explanation be that they were a precursor or a failed attempt at creating a greater weapon against the greater will? A precursor to another paled-skinned race that would rise up and shake the foundations of the Order of the Erdtree to its very core. Perhaps, but we'll look at that more later in the video. For now, let us speak on another product of the Nox that I'm sure you're all waiting to talk about, and this is the Chair Crypts. So at the onset of this chapter, I want to make it clear that there is no direct lore in the game which really acknowledges the purpose of these structures. The only thing we clearly understand is they are of massive importance to the Nox. So please bear in mind the scarcity of in-game lore on these objects, and let's go and speculate together. So let's look at what we can actually see from these thrones. There is one in Nokron and one in Noxtella that is actually occupied, and they're occupied by giant skeletons. There are also a couple of empty ones, one in Noxtella at the church at the top, and significantly, there is one in Celia, Town of Sorcery, which is guarded by a Nox monk and a swordstress. But let us return to Celia in the next chapter and keep focused on the thrones in particular for now. Interestingly, each of the big thrones that house the big skeletons on them also have a chest underneath them which contains a ghost glovewort, which according to the item description for this flower, is used to comfort heroic spirits, a tribute to those who died heroic deaths. We know that these thrones are called Chair Crypts thanks to a site of grace at Celia, and this is fitting, given that the dual purpose of these structures is having a chair up top and having a crypt below. So how do we explain these thrones and the giant corpses upon them? What follows will of course be my own speculation, but I believe it all comes back to the society-wide aim of the Nox and the description that we found within their armour pieces. Remember, it reads that the Nox are essentially banished here and have nothing more to hope for than the Age of Stars and their Lord of Night. We have seen the Nox has already attempted several experiments to bring this about. Could it be that these giants were attempts at creating an artificial Lord of Night, an artificial god? The fact they are sat upon a throne makes me think that this was supposed to be a being of great importance. With the limited information that we have, this is what I ultimately believe to be the case. The thrones are symbolic of lordship, of course, and the glovewort is left underneath to tribute the failed experiment who'll have died a hero trying to free their people. I think the importance of these giant beings is also highlighted by the fact that they are female characters, and we have already touched on the fact that the potential Lord of Knights all do seem to be female. Surrounding the throne in Noxtella, in the kind of water area, we also find another quandary, and I just want to take the chance now, since we're speculating anyway, to address this, and this is the petrified people that we see in both Nokron and Noxtella. To me, these people have always been reminiscent of a cross between the messengers from Bloodborne with the petrified people of Pompeii in real life. However, there's another From Software reference that I think that is related to these people, and that is the event that we see in Yharhar Ghul, specifically the second time we visit the area after the moon has been beckoned. At this point in Bloodborne, we see that the School of Mentis are performing their ritual to summon the One Reborn, and in general the town has transformed quite dramatically from the first time you visit it in the opening act of Bloodborne. We see that there are people added to the environment, petrified people, all climbing up the walls, stuck in the walls, becoming part of the walls, as if they've been caught in the waves of some cosmic cataclysm, some kind of ritual, as a result of the School of Mensis meddling. This is very reminiscent of what we see in the Eternal Cities to me. The Nox are trying with all their power to beckon the Age of Stars, through rituals, through religion, and through experimentation, and in a way they do remind me of the School of Mensis. To me, it seems as though these petrified remains are the result of one of many unknown Nox practices, some of the ones we've examined, and some that we probably don't know about. The fact they are almost growing out of the ground, walls, and roofs suggests that they aren't human life forms. Indeed, they are some kind of cosmic life that has started to be summoned while this unknown process began. This is, of course, 100% speculation. There is no in-game lore supporting this or any other reason why these petrified people exist. But to me, they are not statues. They are all in different positions. Some look like they're praying. Some look like they're crying. But to me, it reminds me of Bloodborne and the beckoning rituals in Yharhar Ghul. And so my instinct is that these are the result of a failed ritual of the Nox. So we've covered the thrones, and yet there is one anomaly among them. One that exists not below, but above, on the surface. Why is there a throne in Celia? What is Celia's connection to the Eternal Cities? Let us now explore the Noxian links outside of the Eternal Cities. Outside of Rhea Lucaria, there is only really one other centre of learning for magic, and that is of course Celia, the town of sorcery in Caelid. Celia is of course the most well known for its association with Radahn and gravity magic. We are told by Radahn's remembrance that he learned such powers in Celia, in order to be able to continue to ride his scrawny horse, Leonard. We also learn from Rock Sling and other spells that he was in fact taught by an alabaster lord, beings that are suggested to not be of this world, but are masters of gravity magic. Indeed, he would use such techniques learned from this alabaster lord to halt the movement of the stars during the Star Scourge conflict, in which he would save the town from a coming catastrophe. While this may be a laudable achievement of the Town of Sorcery contributing to its own survival, there is certainly a darker association hidden just beneath the surface. This darkness is aptly described by the item descriptions of the so-called Night Sorceries, and just by the name, you may already see where this is going. It quickly becomes quite clear that Celia is the centre for developing these sinister Night Sorceries. And again, we quickly learn the purpose of such surreptitious practices. For example, the Night Shard Sorcery tells us, "The Selen sorcerers were assassins, and it is said they often hunted their fellows." A more prominent and important example of these Night Sorcery is probably the Unseen Form, as it will relate to the Black Knives that we look at later, as the description of this spell reads, "Makes the camera semi-invisible. While on horseback, effect extends to cover the mount. The Selen assassins considered every option that aided their dirty work." So these Selen assassins used the power of the Night Sorceries to obscure and hide their form before assassinating their targets. Their forms are only revealed when up close. Does this sound familiar to any other enemies that we see in the game? Indeed, the clues to the origin of this magic and Celia itself can be seen in the symbol the town has taken, the Throne of Celia, the Throne of the Nox. Indeed, the link between Celia and the Nox is confirmed by the Eternal Darkness spell, and more importantly, the Night Maiden's Mist, which reads as follows. "One of the Night Sorceries of Celia, Town of Sorcery. Below Celia, the Eternal City of Nokron sleeps. This sorcery originates from the Maiden of that place." So we can clearly see that the Town of Celia is tied to the Nox in some way. We have the Throne of the Nox here, the Throne of the Nox and their symbol, and these Night Sorceries seem to originate from the Eternal Cities. Another NPC, Gowri, suggests that the Selians are actually Nox descendants themselves. After you provide Millicent with the needle, as per his directions, he states the following.
"As thanks, I vow to impart to you my knowledge of the lost sorceries of the Selians, descendants of the Eternal."
In a straightforward sense, this tells us that Celia is an offshoot colony of the Nox, and it makes sense given its proximity to the Eternal City itself, essentially sitting right atop Nokron. And so we do have to wonder, what is the aim of the Nox here? Why influence Celia and go as far to have a presence on the surface at all? Clearly this town is important to the Nox. As evidenced by their heavy presence here, we can find silver tier balls, we can find a monk and a swordmistress guarding the throne. Well, first and foremost, and in the most straightforward manner, it seems the Nox used this overworld colony as a research station for new types of magic, the Night Sorceries and Gravitational Magic. The Nox clearly had some sort of relationship with an Alabaster Lord who helped them develop Gravitational Magics. Even more fascinating is when we consider the presence of the Selian Crystal Tunnel nearby, where Gravity Stones are mined by the Kilo, and a Falling Star Beast has made his lair here, meaning that Celia is literally well placed to help the Nox develop further magics related to the cosmos. Another consideration is this town is important because the Nox have essentially used it to train a type of mage assassin, with types of magic that will be used later in the Night of the Black Knives. Then there's of course the throne, and something that is interesting may relate to us is a note passed to us by Gowri, titled Celia's Secret, which reads, "The town of Celia hides the source. Light three flames atop the candle towers to break the seal." So the town itself is hiding something known as the source, and given the fact the Nox and their throne are very much tucked away behind one of these seals that we need to break, I would suggest that the source is most likely this Noxian throne, and therefore their relationship with the Nox, the source of the town itself, is the secret that Celia keeps. If we follow my theory regarding these thrones, it seems as though the Nox are wanting to attempt to use Celia as another testing ground for building their artificial lords. And given that Celia have taken the throne as their own symbol, it seems the town is fully on board. Interestingly, this chair crypt holds the Staff of Lusat, a powerful Selen native, and this item is essentially guarded by the two Nox who keeps the item in their chest. This begs the question, were they intending that Lusat would take this throne and become the next giant skeleton in an attempt to raise a Lord of Night. It's possible. Lusat is clearly an influential and powerful sorcerer, with strong ties to the primeval current itself, and therefore strong ties to the stars. This is just speculation, of course, from finding Lusat's staff in this chest underneath the crypt. But of course, it is important to note that Lusat is an important member of Selen society, so at the very least it does make sense that they would guard a sacred relic of his. Lusat himself is a good example of the bridge that Celia has created between the Eternal City and the wider world at large, and it is to the subject of further external influence that we turn to next. I don't believe we can truly appreciate the influence that the Nox have had on the lands between without touching on the influence they clearly have had on the Academy of Rhea Lucaria. Indeed, some of this influence comes from the relationship that the Academy has had with the Town of Sorcery, a Noxian colony. We learn this from the Glintstone Star spell, for its description reads, "A sorcery of the Elevenus Conspectus," which attracts sorcerers from Celia, Town of Sorcery. So I've spoken at length on the Conspectus before in my Primeval Current lore video, but put simply, the Conspectus are different schools of magic scholarship that focus on different practice of sorceries. What is interesting is that this school was founded by Lusat, the primeval sorcerer, for the Olivinus Conspectus crown reads as follows. The lineage of the Olivinus Conspectus began with the sorcerer Lusat, and its adherents continue his study of meteors. As we mentioned, Lusat is of course himself a native of Celia, and we learn this from Selen in the course of her quest when she is looking for Lusat. So despite the fact that Lusat would turn his studies towards the primeval current, it would seem as though he was initially a sorcerer focused on the more gravitational side of things when he first came to Rhea Lucaria, and he would find a school in that name, and this makes sense given he comes from the town which focused on gravitational magics. Of course, a school focused on gravitational magic and founded by a Celia native would then attract scholars from Celia, thus subtly increasing Nox's influence within the Academy and the lands between as a whole. The connection between the two centres of learning is further cemented by the presence of Rhea Lucarian sorcerers at Celia, who seem to be mastering the obscuring techniques of Celia, as well as the avionettes and marionettes, tools of the Academy used as soldiers and guards. So as you can already see, the influence of the Nox runs much deeper and more insidiously than we may first assume through this bridge between Celia and Rhea Lucaria. Of course, one of the main connections between the Academy and the Nox is with the obsession with the stars and the cosmos, one that is also quite clearly shared by the Carrion royal family, and the link between the moon, the Nox, and these royals is also extremely strong. Rinala and Rani are heirs of this belief, and in our way are heirs of the Nox themselves. We know from the Stargazer heirloom that the fate latent within the stars is what led a young astrologer, Rinala, to her destiny, the full moon, and it was this moon that would then form the basis of Rinala's rule and founding of her Carrion royal family. The Academy is mainly focused on the study of Glintstone, and yet Rinala's encounter with the moon would in turn lead her bringing its influence to the Academy itself, balancing the study of Glintstone and the stars with that of the moon. In turn, this reliance upon the moon was something that would be passed down to Rani, as we learn from the description of the drawstring Freezing Grease, which reads, "The women of the Carrion royal family took to the moon to guide their fates. Rani's is a moon dark and blanketed with rime." I find this interesting because it seems to me that Rani's moon, the dark moon, is more an aspect or version of the moon which is concerned with the occult and overthrowing the golden order of the Erdtree, much like the Black Moon of the Nox. And this returns us to the Black Moon of Noxtella, and as I said right at the onset of this video, I believe this moon to be an important aspect of Nox society until it was destroyed. We learn of it from the talisman of the same name, which reads as follows. This talisman represents the lost Black Moon. The moon of Noxtella was the guide of countless stars. I believe the moons encountered by Rani and her mother are different moons, and the Black Moon is a different moon even then, thus their respective moons led them down different paths. All three of these moons are referred to by different titles. Rinala's is the full moon, Rani's is the dark moon, and the one of the Nox is the Black Moon. And indeed, if we look at Renala's Full Moon, Rani's Dark Moon spells, and compare that to the Black Moon Talisman, we can see that all three are depicted in very different ways. Renala's is bright and white, Rani's is dark and blue. And you don't need to take my word for it that these are different moons, as we see these different moons in the game. If we look at the moon in Lunaria, it is bright and full. It is the full moon of Renala. Then compare it to this keen observation by YouTuber and Twitch streamer Saint Riot, who noted that you can see briefly, only before you rest or leave the area, you can see Rani's dark moon present over Radahn's arena after you defeat him. This is a great observation, and I highly recommend you check out Saint Riot's channel and their Twitch streams, as he's a very entertaining PvPer and lore playthrough, and I will leave links to his channel in the description below. However, the most obvious presence of both two moons is when we visit the area called Moonlight Altar, where we see both Renala's full moon and Rani's dark moon plainly in the sky for us both to see at the same time. This, for me, reinforces the fact that these are not normal celestial bodies. They are a force, a being of some kind, and most likely outer gods themselves. As the Moon of Noxtella Talisman describes, the Black Moon was a guide for stars, and indeed, the moons do seem to be guides towards their chosen people. Unfortunately for the Nox, their guide, their Black Moon, is no longer around, and we can learn that it was essentially destroyed when we read the Memory Stone item description, which reads as follows. Said to be a fragment of the Black Moon that once hung above the Eternal City. And as I noted earlier, this is the same black marbling effect we see on the chairs in the Eternal City themselves, and whether they are actual fragments of the moon or just replicas is for us to decide. The talisman said the moon once hung above the Eternal City, again reinforcing the fact it is no longer there, and given the fact that fragments are used for other items now, we can assume that the moon is not just gone, but shattered and destroyed. Thus the Nox will have lost the guidance Rani now enjoys, and no doubt this is what leads them down the desperate paths that we see them take by experimenting on different life forms. So the Nox are no stranger to disasters that befall their own kind. So now let us look at the most obvious example of this, and this is the coming of Asteel. Evidently, the Nox have suffered. Not only have they been cursed for eternity under a mocking false sky, but even in their imprisonment, they have not gone untouched, as evidenced by the coming of Asteel. We have numerous pieces of in-game lore evidence that directly tells us that this being assaulted the Eternals. For example, the Wing of Asteel reads, "Crafted from a relic of the Natural Born of the Void, who is said to have assailed the Eternal City." So when trying to understand this event, I believe it is best to start with the most logical talking point, and that is the Remembrance of Asteel, which reads as follows. "A malformed star born in the lightless void far away, once destroyed an Eternal City and took away their sky, a falling star of ill omen." So straight away, we can see that Asteel is credited with not only attacking the Nox, but actually laying low one of their cities. Clearly, this is where we return to the destroyed city found in the Deeproot Depths. And specifically, we learn of how Asteel destroyed this city from the Meteorite of Asteel spell, which reads as follows. "A manifestation of the power with which Asteel leveled the Eternal City." This, of course, being the Meteorite ability, which he uses in his fight with us, where he brings a storm of meteorites from the void from whence he hails. Using this spell, he obviously destroyed the Eternal City. Additionally, as we learn from his remembrance, Asteel reportedly took away their sky. And indeed, the destroyed city is no longer shrouded in the false sky that covers the sister cities of Nokron and Noxtella. I think it is therefore patently obvious that this is the city that was subjected to the wrath of Asteel, the city destroyed and its sky taken. Its inhabitants being left as nothing but corpse food for the ants that live in this area of the Deeproot Depths. Yet why did Asteel come here, and why are there copies of him in various places throughout the lands between? So I discussed Asteel in quite a bit of detail in my Primeval Current lore video, which I would recommend you watch. In that we discussed the fact that stars, even malformed ones like Asteel, are born in the lightless void of space, and therefore initially it would seem that Asteel is far removed from the very much grounded Nox. But I'm once again going to speculate because I do believe there is a satisfying explanation for Esteel's coming and why he came here and targeted the Eternal Cities specifically. We have already discussed the Black Moon, that it was a guide for countless stars. No doubt the Nox were using this as a hope to bring stars to them that the Black Moon would guide to this world, and therefore bring about the Age of Stars. And yet, what if something happened that neither the Nox or the Black Moon expected? That a star was indeed guided here, but that star was malformed, rogue and anarchic, an ill omen to even the Nox and the Black Moon. A creature of malevolence and chaos, Esteel came, guided by the Black Moon, and destroyed the third city of the Eternals and shattered the Black Moon before making itself a lair in a cave near Noxtella. This is why we find him resting here beyond Noxtella, and his duplicates are also present throughout the Underground Realm. Esteel is capable of duplication, as we see during his fight with us in the consecrated snowfield. With the destruction of the city covered, we have one major final topic to cover: the Eternal City's involvement in the Night of the Black Knives, a subject that we've already covered at the beginning of the video, but let's come full circle for the last couple of minutes of this video. As I've already mentioned, Rani walks a very similar path to the Nox before her, guided by her Dark Moon, and clearly she has come into contact with them by walking this path. One of the most in-your-face examples of this is the fact that one of Rani's counsellors, Iji, wears a mirror helm, which is a piece of technology crafted by the Nox themselves. And we learn this from the Nox mirror helm, which reads, "Helm fashioned from crystal looking glass, one among the Eternal City's ritual implements. Worn by those committed to high treason, it wards off the intervention of the greater will and its vassal fingers." So once again, the skill of Noxian craftsmanship comes to the fore, with Rani's own people imitating Nox craft to act against their greater will rather than developing new technologies themselves. These mirror helms seem to act as a sort of tinfoil hat to protect the internal schemes of those who oppose the greater will from being read by the greater will or its vassals. It would make sense that the Dark Moon would guide Rani down the path towards the Nox, given they have already paved this path for her. With the loss of the Black Moon, the Nox most certainly took a huge hit to their aspirations of bringing about the Age of Stars, and most likely the first contact between Rani and these people will have seemed like a new opportunity for the Nox, who will most likely, at the first instance, wanted to help her achieve the Age of Stars. Yet if this was to be achieved between the two parties, there was an issue. Rani had already been selected by the greater will to be an Empyrean, tethered to their will by her Empyrean flesh. This was something, of course, she must rectify to bring about her Age of Knights and follow her Dark Moon to her conclusion. And this is her true motivation in organising the Night of the Black Knives, as we learn from the mouth of Rani herself.
"But I would not acquiesce to the two fingers. I stole the Rune of Death, slew mine own Empyrean flesh, casting it away. I would not be controlled by that thing."
Rani plots the Night of the Black Knives and utilises what we know to be the Black Knife Assassins. And as we have discussed at length, these were women of the Eternal City, or Numen women. And in the Black Knife Assassins, we see everything we know about Nox lore coming together. The cloaks that fool the eye, as described by Rogier, is clearly some type of magic that was researched in Celia that obscures their form. The all-female makeup of the assassins makes us think of the all-female warrior class, the Sword Maidens. And of course, the fact that they are helping Rani is because they want to bring about the Age of Night, which they have so desperately tried different ways to obtain. Most likely, it was Noxtella that she came into contact with and recruited her allies from. Given she has a teleporter to their very city in Rena's Tower, and the fact that when we come into the picture in the future, past the Night of the Black Knives, she and her followers had still not yet discovered Nokron, leaving Noxtella to be the only logical city that Rani allied with at the time of the Night of the Black Knives. The rest of what we know about the Night of the Black Knives is, as they say, already history. The video is long enough without doing a full analysis of the assassination attempt itself, but suffice it to say that at this time, Rani conspired with the people of Noxtella to bring down the gods of the Erdtree. Given the Nox have long awaited their Lord of Night, it would make sense to support Rani in this, their best hope for a new age. Yet this is what she will have sold them on. Yet Rani's true aim was to slay her own flesh so she could follow her own path to become the Lord of Night. In the Shadow Beast lore video, I suggested that Rani was still in command of the Black Knife Assassins, and that it was she who ordered the execution of her own counsellors, E.G. and Blythe, who both have the corpses of assassins surrounding them at the end of her quest as a way of tying up loose ends. However, people challenged me on this in this video, with comments arguing against it, and I have reconsidered, and I do acknowledge there is a different angle, especially when we look at Rani's motivations for this night. These comments argued that, in fact, the Black Knives are now acting against Rani, and they slay Rani's counsellors out of revenge rather than doing it at her command. And again, like I just said, I've considered this to be a real plausible explanation, having ruminated on the purposes behind Rani's Knight of the Black Knives. Consider this, is it possible that the assassins believed that this was the start of a glorious and bloody revolution against the gods that would raise the Nox up and their Lord of Night? But instead, Rani misled them and used them to slay her own flesh. Given we see the Black Knife assassins are now scattered in prison and in hiding, it does seem like they have taken the fall and Rani has abandoned them while she pursues her own designs. And also consider if she is allied to the Eternal Cities, why do they not simply give her the Fingerslayer blade? Why do we have to rob it from them with Blythe? And ultimately, the Black Knife assassin's attempt on E.G. and Blythe's life does seem to happen after the Nokron Fingerslayer blade is stolen, as if it is an act of revenge or attempt to stop Rani having stolen the blade from them. Regardless of the now existing relationship between the Eternal Cities and Rani, she did successfully use her allies to achieve her aim, which was shed her own Empyrean skin, and by doing so, they did inadvertently play a role in bringing about the Age of Stars, should we choose to help Rani achieve its final ends. And in a way, this is the Eternal City's greatest legacy. They lay the foundations and build the tools that someone else will use to bring about the Age of Stars, namely the Fingerslayer blade, and of course the role they have in freeing Rani from her Empyrean flesh. And this is where I originally wanted to conclude the video, but as I've developed this video, something's been gnawing at the back of my mind, a question, and it's something I'm going to put to yourselves now. Did the Nox have anything to do with the Godskin apostasy? So before doing this video, I'd always treated the Godskin movement and the Knight of the Black Knives as two very separate events, and yet the more I've researched for this video, the more that things have gnawed away at me. Firstly, there's the nature of E.G.'s death. Much like Blythe, there are Black Knife assassins surrounding him, and we've already talked about that. And it again suggests that they are the hand behind his murder, for whatever reason and for whatever master. But there is another detail, of course. E.G. is burning in the black flame, and this is very clearly different from the red flame of Death and Death that the assassins use, and clearly From Software could have put him burning in this red flame if they wanted to, but they chose the black flame. The black flame is clearly indicative of the Godskins, heavily implying the two groups were working in concert to kill E.G. here. In the course of researching this video and writing the script, I have come to the conclusion that there are enough implications about the Godskins that involve or suggest the Nox are involved, and we have to talk about it. Even in my Godskin lore video that I did months ago, I suggested the fact that the Godskins must be a form of artificial or created life, even saying they are something akin to the Albinoryx, and now upon the research and looking back at that video, how right I clearly was. Given everything we have discussed regarding artificial life, I think these links to the Godskins becomes even stronger. Let's look at a lore item, the Godskin Swaddling Cloth, which reads the following. The Glow-Eyed Queen cradles newborn apostles swaddled in this cloth. Soon they will grow to become the death of the gods. This is the item that has always led me to believe that the Godskins are not a natural form of life, given that they don't seem to be people who become apostles, rather they are born apostles, and nurtured by their Glow-Eyed Queen. The phrase, soon they will grow, to become the death of the gods, to me implies a sort of accelerated growth, again, a sign of artificiality. The Godskins have a very unnatural, inhuman look to them, pale white skin reminiscent of the Albinoryx, with yellow corrupted eyes similar to the Nox. Their bodies can contort and move in unnatural ways, and the nobles even incorporate inhuman elements into their bodies. Is it possible that they are the final product in a long line of genetic experimentation, with Silver Tears, and especially the Albinoryx, being earlier and less successful incarnations of this type of work? Given the aims of the Nox are clearly to usurp Marika and her Golden Order, the Godskins would be an incredible, successful weapon, given the danger they posed to Marika and her kin and the lengths they had to go to defeat them. While I do want to emphasise that this is my speculation, but given all we have learned about the Nox and their works with artificiality, the Albinoryx, and the inhuman manner in which the Godskins are born and the way in which their bodies behave, I do believe that the Godskins are one other form of artificial life developed by the Nox, their most successful product to date. This of course raises questions about the Glomide Queen, suggesting she was one of the Nox, or perhaps related to them, perhaps related through her mother. But that, my friends, is a subject for another video, because I'm really, really tired. So that's my overall examination of the Nox, fallen Numen, who would rebel against the greater will for time immemorial. They would build a highly advanced society, dedicated to bringing about the Age of Stars, creating weapons, spells, and lifeforms to bring about the end of the Two Fingers and their servants. In reaching for this goal, they have heavily influenced the Lands Between and a number of its institutions, and by pushing for a new order with their innovations, they help pave the way for Rani and her Dark Moon. So thanks for watching, guys. I hope you enjoyed my take on this breathtaking and expansive subject. While I went deep, I'm sure there's little bits I've missed, so hit me up with your discoveries below and anything you disagree with me on. If you liked this video, please consider subscribing and liking the video. It helps the channel out immensely, and I'm covering Elden Ring lore exclusively at the moment. I also want to give a shout out to my thumbnail artist, Shimhack. I don't really give a shout out to my commissions on the videos, I usually just do it on Twitter, but I thought the artwork for this thumbnail was just so breathtaking that it deserves its own shout out in this video. So please check out Shimhack's stuff below. They are one of the greatest fan artists in the Elden Ring community, and I'll link their stuff below. I highly recommend you check them out and buy some of their stuff on Redbubble. I've got some of their pictures on my wall right now. But aside from that, guys, if you'd like to help out the channel in other ways, I do have a Patreon and channel memberships. The latter are giving you cool badges and more personal members-only posts with me. But until next time, guys, I'm absolutely exhausted, and I will see you next time under the false sky of Nokron. Take care, and have a nice, endless night.